Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 3. 1 Timothy chapter 3. Let's read these first seven verses of 1 Timothy chapter 3. We read them last week. And what I was preaching last week is really the ordination of pastors, the setting apart, the approval, and who is it that approves, who is it that has the authority, who is it that ordains? It's the Lord's churches. And clearly they're assisted by spiritually mature men that are willing to put their reputations on the line, but it's churches, right? It's what I see in the Bible is that Jesus, He said all power was given unto Him, all authority is given unto Him. And then with His authority, He then empowered and instructed and gave authority to His churches. And so we saw that. Now, we will begin to look this week at the 16 characteristics, the 16 elements of a pastor. I've entitled the message this morning, The Musts of a Pastor. You'll see I get that from verse 2 where it says, a bishop then must. And it lists 16 things. I want to encourage you. Initially, I had all 16 of those for Abby to put on a slide. I'm only going to do 15. I'm only going to do 8. I told her, I said, don't even prepare the other 8. At the most, I'm doing 8. And we'll see how I do with that. I think I have a shot. So let's see this. Now, one other thing I want you to understand when you read through this, and I have to prove this to you, but I think I can. I loved Eric. He came up to me last week, and he said, yeah, I'm talking about you now. He doesn't realize that. Marchand does. Marchand, you can tell when she gets serious, she will not move her neck. But, you know, Marchand's one of these people, when she walks by, she's like, how you doing? You know, and so when Marchand, I'm just calling too much attention. But I appreciate Eric because he came up to me last week, and he goes, that must be daunting what you have to preach in 1 Timothy chapter 3. And it is. In its most absolute sense, I don't know if there's any man that is absolutely qualified. There's not. It's rough. It's decisions that the Lord's churches have to make. And each church has to make that decision. And you could disqualify me with probably all 16. I don't do any of them, even close to absolute and perfect. But here's the good news, Eric. You are commanded to have all 16 of these attributes as well. And I'll give you the scriptures, some of them today. But when you're looking for a pastor, these are the things that you should highlight. These are the things that you should scrutinize. These are the things that you should look for. Clearly, you want to understand what they believe, and you want to understand their doctrinal, their biblical teaching and what they believe. But that's a given. But these are characteristics of the man. What should the man possess? And it is daunting. It is intimidating. But they're here nonetheless. And let's see what we can glean from that and be challenged by it, each one of us this morning. 1 Timothy chapter 3 verse 1 says this. This is a true saying. If a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach, not given to wine, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous, one that ruleth his own house, one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Verse 6, not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into reproach in the snare of the devil. The must of a pastor. It is daunting. The first one that shows up here, you'll see there in verse 2, a bishop. Now remember, I explained this to you. We don't use bishop in Baptist churches. Some do, and it's fine if you use bishop. Bishop's a biblical term. Bishop, Pastor and elder are three titles used for the office of a pastor. Elder doesn't always refer to the office of a pastor. You have to know the context, but an elder can be a pastor. And so bishop just means overseer, pastor just means shepherd, and then elder just means spiritually mature, someone that you can look for guidance and in biblical wisdom. But he says here, a bishop must be blameless. And so it's blameless. So what does blameless mean? It's overwhelming. It's you've got to be above reproach, right? And I think about that. It's you're beyond accusation. It's a little intimidating. What I try to do is I want us to look at some scriptures that'll help us maybe understand blameless in its greater context. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 5 to 7. It talks about widows indeed. We'll get there in weeks to come. Blameless. A pastor must be blameless. It's an overwhelming thought, but I think I can bring it into some perspective that can help us a little bit. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 5 to 7 says this. Now she that is a widow indeed, and desolate. So just so you know, I mean, I don't like to read things and not give you understanding. A widow indeed is someone, it's a woman that has no family to take care of her. The first line of defense for taking care of your family is family. So my mother-in-law, needy man, I'm telling you. But no, it's okay. But I know this, my mother-in-law, she needs to go to her own children before she turns to me, 100%. No, but I'm responsible for my mother-in-law before this church will be responsible. But she may kill me. And all, you know, but if she's left alone and she has no family, then the church should take care of her. And that's biblical. So a widow indeed is one that doesn't have family, doesn't have children, doesn't have sons-in-laws, daughters-in-law that will take care of her. We are the first line of defense, and we need to rejoice in that. This is important, that when God establishes His ways, that we rejoice in His ways. A lot of times we go, yeah, that's what God wants. We act like it's misery. I just, you know. But it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Let's delight in that. And it's difficult. Aging is difficult. But let's delight in God's ways as well. And so a widow indeed. A widow indeed. So let's read first. That's not why I turned us there. Now she that is a widow indeed and desolate trusteth in God and continueth in supplications and prayers night and day. But she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth. And these things give in charge that they may be blameless. Here's the context. It uses the word blameless there at the end of verse 7. It's dealing with widows. And you kind of, chapter 5 will be fun when we get there. We've got bad widows and good widows. And so it deals with this and it says, you know, the widow indeed that's desolate, she has nothing. That's a good thing. The Bible doesn't bemoan that. The Bible says this. When that widow is desolate, that widow indeed, she has nothing, she has nobody, she'll trust in God. That's a good thing. It says she'll trust in God and she'll continue in supplications and prayers night and day. Because if God doesn't help her, she's doomed. That's a good thing. The other widows are the widows that live in pleasure and are dead while they live. Here's what I believe blameless is. If we want to be blameless, we need to be eternally minded. The widow indeed that has nothing, that's desolate, she realizes this, God's my only hope and I'm going to focus on God. I'm not going to become some busybody. It talks about that later in 1 Timothy chapter 5. I'm going to trust in the Lord. I'm going to seek the Lord. I'm going to ask for supplications and prayers. I'm going to continue in those night and day. And she's more eternally minded. I want to take you over to Luke chapter 1. I want to show you another couple that the Bible describes as blameless. As blameless. While you're turning there, I was just having a little fun when I thought of blameless as I was growing up. I was always blamed for everything. Middle child, any other middle children here? Middle children, is that consistent? Oldest one, too old. Youngest one, the baby. The middle one, it's your fault. All the time, it's your fault. I probably earned it. Blameless. I'll tell you just a quick story. maybe I don't think I've ever told this story. Maybe I haven't. So just put up with this story if I've told this. I don't think I've told this publicly before. Maybe I have. You'll find out why I shouldn't. But we grew up and it was a two-story house, and above our family room was the bathroom that my sisters and I shared. And so one day I had a bad day and the toothbrush dropped in the toilet. And I hadn't flushed. And so I was like, ooh, I am not in that toothbrush right now. The toothbrush was going in the garbage anyway. So I had this brilliant idea, not being an engineer technically minded. I thought, I'll first flush and then get the toothbrush with clean water. Well, miracle of miracles, my toothbrush goes down the toilet. I'm like, oh no. I know it didn't go all the way through. And so, got a huddle with my sisters. And I identified our bathroom as, okay, I'll try not to, as, okay, just a, as a pee-only toilet. You know, number one. You can only go number one in this toilet, right? And we got agreement. I got signed, you know, confessions and everything. Because, I mean, I knew how to work it. That worked for months. Sunday afternoon, my dad and I are sitting downstairs. I think we're watching some sports program. And all of a sudden, from the ceiling comes water just pouring down. Without hesitation, my dad, I'm not upstairs. He turns and he goes, what did you do? And I'm like, I'm not up there. And so I knew what happened. We violated the code. We used that toilet for more than number one. It's not my fault. I mean, long story short, you know, I mean, blameless, right? I mean, I was always blamed, right? I mean, I told you this, don't do this at home, right? I was told this. I was told that, you know, ping pong, I loved playing ping pong when I was a kid, right? So you'd get the dented ping pong balls and they don't, you know, they couldn't buy like a 64 pack like you can buy today, right? It's just, you know, you'd get them three at a time and your parents would act like, get my whole paycheck for those ping pong balls. I'm like, they're that expensive? You know, so we never had many ping pong balls. And so I would, you know, the dented ones. And so a guy told me, he said, hey, you know how to get the dents out? This is not true. Do not try this at all. He said, just light a match and hold it near the ping pong ball. It'll warm up and pop right out. I found out what the most flammable thing known to man is. I don't know what's inside a ping pong ball, but if you need to start a fire, just throw a couple ping pong balls in there and it's great kindling. I mean, so... The ping pong ball, I kid you not, the flame was like this. Here's the bad idea. I tried to heat the ping pong ball in the family room. I should have done it in the garage over concrete. Well, when you get a big flame out, what are you going to do? Just hold it? No, I threw it. And if you know, this carpet is mainly made of plastic. I've learned a lot, okay, through the years. I didn't know it was mainly plastic until it just kind of wrapped ping pong ball in that carpet. They were brothers and sisters, and they just became one. And I was like, oh. So it was kind of near the hearth, near the fireplace hearth. And so my dad had this ceramic dog that he liked, and I thought, that dog needs to move. So I moved the dog, and I put it over the burnt-out carpet spot, you know. And so my dad comes home, and it's just crazy, right? I wasn't blameless as a child. He didn't even move the dog. He walks in, he goes, what did you do? Why did you move that dog? And I'm like, oh, well, I mean, you know. And so, needless to say, that's where the dog was forevermore. But I'm not sure that's what blameless is. But, you know, we want to be beyond reproach. But I want you to look at Luke chapter 1. I want you to show this couple. This couple, it's one of the greatest descriptions that God can give us, is to be blameless. And you want to be a pastor? You got to be beyond reproach. That's daunting. It's probably one of the most overwhelming ones on this list, blameless. It says in Luke chapter 1, it says, there was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias of the course of Abia, and his wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking in the commandments and ordinances of the Lord blameless. Now you have this couple, Zacharias, he was a priest, and you have his wife Elizabeth, and later in Luke 1, as you continue to read, it says that they were old, stricken in age, they were beyond childbearing, and if you understand historically, the greatest thing was to have children. You get married, oh, you love your spouse, but we wanna have kids. And you know what I love about them? They didn't have children, but they were blameless. It didn't go the way they wanted, but they were focused on God. It says that they were righteous before God. And to me, that's a little bit picture of blameless. We see the widows indeed. The widows indeed. They're desolate. They have nothing. They've lived their life serving the Lord, and they have nothing, and no bitterness. No anger at God. They love Him, and He's the one they turn to. I see Zacharias and Elizabeth. They've served God. They were faithful, and yet no children. We love Him. If God says no children, we're going to live for Him, and they were blameless. Is that amazing? It's sort of this perspective that says, and it's, again, it's daunting, that what happens if our church doesn't go the way I want? What happens if, you know, you have dreams, they don't go the way I want? Will I be righteous? Will I love God? Will I do what's right when it doesn't go the way I want? That's tough. I want you to turn over to 2 Peter chapter 3. I want you to show you this. In my notes, if you could see them, I have under each one, instruction for non-pastors. And it commands us, when we're not pastors, to be blameless. And blameless, I've tried, you know, from a pure definition perspective, it means without reproach. Blameless kind of means what you'd think. It means, man, you're doing everything right. That's in its absolute sense. But I think I get in its practical sense, it is that we are eternally minded, that when things don't go the way we want, will we continue to trust in God? Will we continue to honor Him? Will we continue to love the Lord, even when He doesn't do what we want? But it commands us in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 14. It says, wherefore, beloved, seeing that you look for such things, always dangerous to just jump into a passage. I'll do that too much today. Wherefore, beloved, seeing that you look for such things, be diligent that you may be found of Him in peace, without spot, and blameless. It is, it'll be our challenge. And I want you to turn over to one verse real quickly. I want you to turn over to Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2. This will be our challenge. And I'm not escaping this. You understand the responsibility and the authority to call a pastor, to install a pastor, to have a pastor. That's your all's job. And it's difficult. It's difficult. But here's the spirit that we want to avoid. It's Romans chapter 2, verse 1. After that amazing chapter 1 that deals with the evil slide of men downward when they aren't thankful and they refuse to acknowledge God. But it says in Romans chapter 2 verse 1, it says, therefore thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest. For wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself. For thou that judgest doest the same things. Here's my request for you. As these things go through your mind, I want you to first do a personal inventory. Look at yourself and say, am I blameless? Do I love God even when things don't go the way I want? Am I eternally minded or am I just constantly just all about me? So first do a personal inventory, but secondly, it's this. This will be okay. There'll be some of these and it's okay. I'm not bothered by that. Let's avoid the spirit of Romans chapter 2 verse 1. But if you go, whoa, disqualified. Our pastor, loser. Or would it be that way for you guys? I can't. Is it that way for you guys? Is that how the L is correct? Here's what I do. When you see that I struggle with some of these qualifications, would you pray for me in love? It's okay. Look, I am blameless. Right out the gate, the first one says, who can be blameless? I am blameless in the sense of through Christ, but the Bible wants me to be blameless in this body. Because I pastor in a body, and He wants me to be blameless. You pray for me. I do not want to bring reproach to the cause of Christ. I would far rather be dead. I would far rather suffer. And I don't want to suffer. But you pray that I will not bring reproach to the cause of Christ. Second one I want you to look at in chapter 3, verse 2. He says, a bishop, the overseer, not the boss man, not the dictator, but the overseer. The bishop then must be blameless. The husband of one wife. The husband of one wife. And so, you know, it's consistent. Remember, chapter 3 flows out of chapter 2. And so what I love is it deals with, remember in chapter 2 we dealt with that passage that dealt with the struggles that we would have in really reaching souls. It talks about men. Look at it, it talks about men. In verse 8 he says of chapter 2, he says, I will therefore that men pray everywhere. Men, we think we can fix it. We try to do things without seeking God. We need to pray. We need to lift up holy hands. Men, you know what we do? We try to serve the Lord with filthy hands. Dirty hands. We try to witness and we're not right with God. He says this, you know, if you want to be an effective witness, you need to seek me and you need to do right. Be clean. And men, we struggle with wrath. We struggle with doubting. And so then he moves into the ladies. What is a barrier for ladies being focused on the gospel? He says, ladies, you know, adorn yourselves with modest apparel. And I know this. We talk this, right? Ladies, the focus isn't about the external. The focus is on the internal. Then he moves into these difficult passages that say, let the woman be learn in silence with all subjection. He says in verse 12, I suffer not a woman to teach nor to usurp authority. But he also tells us why. They weren't designed to rule over men within the Lord's churches. I'll speak specifically to that. It says that Eve was deceived, though she was still in sin, she was still in the transgression. But Adam was not. I want you to know, I think it's broader than this, but this is my conviction, and it's just, I believe the Bible straight up. One of the musts of a pastor is you've got to be a man. And so, you know, I want to let you know is if there's a woman pastor out there, does that mean she's not a Christian? That doesn't mean she's not a Christian. Not at all. We have to be real careful. It's just, I'm telling you, she doesn't have biblical authority to be a pastor. That's all I'm saying. And I'm not trying to rip on her. I'm not trying to demean her. I'm just telling you, if we want to be biblical, then a pastor will be a man. That's not popular in the year 2018. And it doesn't mean that men are better than women. We talked about that before, but you can't be the husband of one wife if you're a woman. But the Bible is consistent with that because just a few verses before that, right? It said that I suffer not a woman to teach nor to usurp the authority over men. You couldn't be a pastor as a woman without teaching men, without usurping their authority because while I am an authority, I'm not the boss. Do you understand? There's a difference. I am an authority, but I'm not the boss. We are a congregational government. And so one of the must is we've got to be blameless. We've got to be a man. Now then, what does it mean the husband of one wife? Great debate. There are some that would say you can't be a pastor if you're divorced. This passage doesn't say that. I believe what this passage is dealing with is this. You have to be a one-woman man. Now the interesting thing is some will say, and here's what I love. You know what? I know churches that say we could never have a divorced pastor as our pastor. And I say, praise the Lord. I love the independence of churches. But that's not what this teaches. Now, to be a one-woman man, I think that's one at a time. I think it's dealing with polygamy. Polygamy is such a foreign concept to us, but I believe it's partly because God instituted that in His churches. It was an issue when this was written in the first century, and it has become almost non-existent, even in most parts of the world. There's still polygamy in other parts of the world. I believe it's an abuse of women. And God said this, you know what? If you're going to be a pastor, one woman man. Now here's the debate. There are scriptural reasons for divorce, and there are unscriptural reasons for divorce. If a man was married and his wife leaves him and deserts him and it ends in divorce, the Bible says he's not under bondage, he's free to remarry. If a man is married to a woman and she goes and she is unfaithful to that man, the Bible says, except for the cause of adultery, you should not be divorced. 1 Corinthians 7 then gives the cause of desertion that I just mentioned, if you want to go back and study that. So you can, there's three reasons for biblical divorce, right? One is sexual unfaithfulness of a spouse. It doesn't mean you have to get divorced. Do you know this? God would want every marriage to stay together if it could. It would suggest that sexual unfaithfulness, you are now no longer bound. You can be free. Secondly, it would be they desert you. They desert you, and they can desert you in a number of ways. Look, I just want you to know what your pastor believes. So if you don't like it, you can love me, we can talk about it. I believe this, desertion, if a man beats on a woman, he's deserted his responsibilities, and I believe she has biblical grounds to leave him and divorce him. You may not agree with me. I 100% believe that's the case. You see, Jesus constantly told us, He said, you all are worrying about the letter, and I'm worrying about the spirit. It's the spirit. I think that's the spirit. Men, we've always been the abusers. I hope and pray there's no one in this room that you are beating on your wife in any way, both physically or verbally. It's just wrong, men. We just need to face that. We'll deal with that next week. We'll deal with what it means to be a brawler next week. But not this week. So here's what I believe. It's this. Acceptable reasons for divorce would be sexual unfaithfulness. It doesn't mean you have to. Would be desertion or death. Those that say, oh no, you can only have one wife. Well, they all of a sudden they say, but if she dies, you can remarry. Well, that would not fit this passage. Here's what I believe this passage is about. It makes it clear. It makes it clear. First, it must be a man. You can't be the husband of one wife and be a woman. So he says, first it must be a man, and then what it says is, it doesn't mean he has to be married, I don't believe it requires that he be married. I think there's probably wisdom in having a married man pastor, but I know there are single men that pastor, and I think there's no disqualification to be single. In fact, 1 Corinthians 7 actually says it's better to be single. You can serve the Lord unencumbered. I think there are many reasons why the Lord has typically pastors to be married, because most people get married. It's good to have children. It'll humble you. You realize you didn't know it all. And before you were a parent, you said, man, I'll never let that happen. You're right. And so, you know, I love this. I watch James. I love his smile back there, right? And I'm sure this goes through your mind, James. I watch this. It took you about 20 minutes to figure out where in the world am I going to sit. I think I'll just sit. I'm just going to sit on Jordan today. You know, and so you were trying to figure that out. And James, it might go through your mind like this. This is not worth it. It's worth it, my friend. It's worth every single irritation, aggravation, distraction. It's worth it. Honor the Lord. It'll be good for you, and it's great for them. You know, I think the devil puts ants in their pants just so that he'll discourage you. And you know what you need to do? Just delight in it and just help there be fewer ants the next time. And delight in it, right? And I watch parents all over, right? I know this, right? It's good. And so understand this. I believe that the intent is that most pastors will be married. I don't think it's a requirement. So here's the difficulty. I don't believe this, just so you want to know what I believe. I believe a divorced man, if it's a biblically approved reason, can pastor. But if there's a church that says, no, baby, no, then you know what? I love that church. I'm not going to criticize that church. If they can't have a man that has been divorced and or remarried, though it was a biblical approved thing, then I say I respect that. I just want you to know, I don't believe divorce disqualifies someone from being a deacon. If the divorce is outside of biblical grounds, I would have more trouble with that. You following me? But I want you to know, I can't find in the Bible that there's two classes of citizens. One that's married and one that's divorced. It's not there. No one should feel like a second class citizen in this room because you're divorced. I can't find it in the Bible, and we need to have a loving, forgiving, and just a loving spirit toward everyone. When it comes to a pastor, husband of one wife, no polygamy. And so then this is the difficulty. If a man leaves his wife for no reason and then remarries, what does the Bible say? He's committed adultery. And so, spiritually, that can in essence make him a two-woman man. That would be my struggle. So just so you know, imagine one day I were just one of you and I wasn't the pastor. I probably wouldn't bring in a pastor to candidate that had unbiblically divorced his woman. That's where I would draw the line. But I tell you all this to say, this is saying that here's what it's talking about. One woman, man. A pastor is a man, and a pastor should only have one wife, and we can get into all the complexities of divorce. That wasn't my intent, but I want to tell you this. Now third, let's look at this. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2. I welcome discussion of this. I know that's a hot button. It's a hot topic. But we want to stay biblical. It says, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant. Vigilant. I want to take you over to 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. Vigilant. This is a verse that deals with the non-pastors. It deals with vigilant, but I think it gives us a good perspective of what does it mean to be vigilant. While you're turning to 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, it says this. Here's what vigilant is. It means to be watchful. It means to be diligent. It means to be disciplined. It means to be, you know, dedicated to for your walk with Christ. You'll see that in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. It'll help you understand that. Vigilance. I like the word vigilance kind of lets you know. And do you love Abby's icon there? How many of you know what that icon is? What is it? It's a ninja. Anybody else know that it was a ninja? Did you know? You didn't know it was a ninja, did you? Wow, okay. That's a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. It is Leonardo. We got a name now. No, that's the ninja. See, and there's a point to that. So enjoy her icons. She has had more fun with these icons than any other message I've preached. Pay attention because it's like this. You are going to be on guard for your spiritual walk. And as a pastor, I need to be vigilant over God's sheep. So look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. This is to the non-pastors, all of us. He says, be sober. We'll see that word come up just next. Be vigilant. Because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour. So when you understand that, be sober. We'll talk about that, but be vigilant. If you think there's a lion out there, if you think there's a lion that's about to attack you, you're going to be wide-eyed. You're going to be a ninja. And so you're going to be, okay, you're going to be paying attention. And so here's what it is. You want a pastor that will be vigilant about his own personal walk, but be vigilant about your personal walk. Ask our teenagers this morning. We're talking about wisdom. And I've enjoyed my time with them. I don't feel resistance. There's a big difference between wanting to do what's right and doing what's right, and that's all of our struggles, right? But I asked him this morning, I said, have you had anybody rebuke you outside of your family? Morgan was the only one. She had a friend. I said, man, that's a good friend. Was she right, though, too, or was she wrong? Did you disagree? She was right. Well, that's good. And so, you know, being vigilant is this, is that you are vigilant with your walk and you'll be vigilant with your family and you'll protect them. There's a roaring lion and it's real. It's the devil. And so vigilance, it's a pastor must be blameless. A pastor must be the husband of one wife. A pastor must be vigilant. 1 Timothy chapter 3 verse 2. It says, a pastor, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant and sober. Sober. I love this. Sober, it's, you guys know this, we've talked about it enough, I think, over time. It's clear-minded, sober-minded, it deals with the mind to be sober, right? And I love this, if you think about this, to be sober-minded is, and I saw this definition, I thought it was good, and we'll look at some passages. It means to curb our affections and desires, to kind of minimize those. And so to be sober-minded means we're not going to let our affections, we're not going to let our desires rule us. We're going to be clear-minded, sober-minded, clear-thinking, and let that drive us. Turn over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 8. This will give us a little bit more understanding, but it's also one of the passages for non-pastors. Let's look at verse 6, then we'll look at verse 8. 1 Thessalonians, right before 1 Timothy, or 2 Thessalonians is, then you can... 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 6. To be sober. He says, therefore, let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. Two verses down, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 8. He says, but let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and for an helmet, the hope of salvation. Now here's what's important. Sober-minded is curbing our affections and desires. Sober-minded, it means that we're somewhat serious-minded. You know I love to be funny. I love for us to smile. I love for us to enjoy life. I believe this, is that joy and peace are just two of the attributes of Christianity when we are just enjoying our Christianity. When we're right with God, joy and peace just flow from us. And they're two great characteristics. We ought not to be sourpusses. We ought not to be negative. It's that, you know, when you're negative, you have no joy and you have no peace, there's probably sin. So, I'm all for that, but sober-minded means this. We are serious about life. We are sober-minded about life that says, I have one life to live. And for us, this is probably not one that, I'm probably more serious than I'm intense, right? I'm imagining my preaching's intense. Maybe it's not. It's not intense like the 60s and 70s guys. I'm not a yeller. I need to get you some old tapes. And I am like a pussycat compared to these guys in the 60s and 70s. But I'm intense. You feel my intensity sometimes, right? I mean, Cleves told me that before, and he feels like I'm trying to pull you in, right? I am. And so there needs to be a seriousness about life. It's one of the challenges for young people today. It's all they're going to do is just, you know, play, 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 fun, 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 silly, silly, silly. And that's all the devil wants to do. Just take away your best years. These are your best years. I don't want you to skip your teenage years. My teenage years have wonderful memories in them. I loved my teenage years. I had amazing energy. You think I have a lot of energy now? Wow. I don't think they had Ritalin back in the day. Right? I mean, they would have been like, hey, triple dose. And, you know, but I mean, I had tons of energy. And my dad knew how to harness it. There's a four-letter word called a belt. And man, he did. He did. So it was... I love my teen years. I promise you this. I want you to love your teen years, but I want you to be serious-minded about them. I want you to enjoy them. And we can have fun. You know, the greatest time of my life is serving the Lord. I know some of you feel a refuge here. Aren't you glad? You're sinning less than you normally do when you're here, aren't you? Isn't it good? I don't know what your besetting sins are, but they don't manifest themselves as much while you're here, do they? Then all of a sudden you're feeling good. You say, man, I love the Lord. And you walk out those doors and it's like Jekyll and Hyde. You know, and We've got to be serious-minded. Got to be serious-minded about the Lord. And you want a pastor that has fun. I love life. But life is serious. Life is real. People are dying and going to hell every single day. That may not be the most pleasant thing to think about, but it is reality. What is it? 54 million people will die this year. 54 million! Most of them lost. Do we care? Sober-minded. Let's look quickly. And you know what? Wow. It's crazy. There's something wrong with that clock. I'm going to finish at number 5 today. All right, number 5. So just so you know, I got to go one more just because I can't. I have to do more than half of what I planned. All right, so it's good. So here, verse 2. I'm sorry. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior. Of good behavior. The best example that I have is of good behavior. It's probably the Good Samaritan. Good behavior doesn't mean that you're a goody two-shoes, but good behavior means you're looking for ways for you to be a blessing to others. Some of you were here on Wednesday night. We watched the screening of the video of the fool. I want you to go home and look at this up on YouTube. Look up Penn Jillette Christian, I think, right? Isn't that what I looked up? It's always dangerous, you know, but I want you to see this video of this atheist. I want you to see this video of this atheist that it was kind of, they didn't allow him to put it on the screening, but you need to see this video of the atheist where he talks about this man that loved him enough to give him a Bible. He said, I still know there's no God. No, he doesn't. But he was so moved. I watched a couple more videos by Penn Jillette. He's an illusionist, magician, comedian kind of guy, well known out in Vegas. And I love this. I saw another video of him, and he said this. He said, let me tell you one thing. He said, I have great respect for Christianity. He said, I have railed on Christians in my comedy sessions. And he says, you know what's crazy? He says, I get letters from Christians. And he said, they're the nicest letters. He says, we disagree with what you said, but we still pray for you. He said, let me tell you this. He says, you know this? He says, I purposely don't make jokes about Muslims. You know why? He said, I have a family. He said, and if I did, my family would be at risk. He said, I will tell you one thing. I don't believe in God, but those Christians, they are different. Isn't that good? An atheist said that. That ought to be what people say about us. Isn't that good? I watched Richard Dawkins, one of the most famous scientists that's an atheist. He's not a scientist. He came in with an opinion and thought he could find science to match it. God is real. He denies that. But I watched Richard Dawkins, and the question was asked of him. Penn Jillette asking this question. He said, tell me, Richard, tell me, how do Christians treat you? And the whole audience began to laugh, thinking it was going to be rough. And he said, I've got to be honest with you. Those people are really nice. Isn't that good? You know, what we have to do is we have to know how to disagree and represent Christ well. I was encouraged. I was encouraged that two guys that say, you know what, there is no God, they're dead wrong. But there were enough Christians around, and they said, you know what, though? Those Christians, they're really nice. That's the kind of good behavior we want to have, isn't it? Make sure of this. There's just no place for us to be spitting fire, mad haters. I meet some Christians and you'd think one of the fruits of the Spirit was being hateful. I've got that down, preacher. So let's work on that. I used to have it down. Used to be, you think I'm a jerk now? I was a jerk on steroids. All I thought was, I need to make sure that I put you in your place and you need to know that you deserve hell. You know, hell is real. We need to understand that. We need to be motivated by that. But I just want to tell you this. Good behavior. Good behavior. And I beg you to do this. Let me tell you my bent. My bent is to be a jerk. I beg you. If I start becoming a jerk in the pulpit, If I start becoming this guy that is not preaching, but I'm preaching with an attitude that is not representative of the Scriptures, would some of our men lovingly take me aside and say, you know what? You're getting hateful. You're getting mean. I want to be able to preach with good behavior. I want to be able to preach with passion. Oh, I preach with passion. I will never apologize for sin. But you know this? I want us to love the sinner. Whatever you think the worst sin is, I want that sinner to be able to come here, and I want them to know that we don't believe that sin is okay, but we're going to love that sinner. You see, good behavior. Man, I was encouraged that these weren't interviews by these men. They could have railed on Christians. And their audience would have said, yeah, yeah, those Christians, they're bad. But these guys were just honest. They go, no, they're amazingly nice. If only that can be us. You know what I once said about your pastor? He's a man of good behavior. He's a man that wants to help people. And you know what I fight every day? Selfishness. Five things we looked at this morning, and then I'll close. A bishop, but it's also us. Let me just show you one other thing, and I'm done. 1 Timothy 2:9. The only other time that the word that's translated good behavior shows up. This is crazy. It just happens twice. The Greek word is twice. It's in verse 9. So it says, in like manner also that women adorn themselves with modest apparel. The word modest in verse 9 is also the word that's translated good behavior in verse 2. And so I'll close with that on good behavior. It's this. Good behavior is such that it says this. When women dress in modest apparel, you know, and they're not trying to draw attention to themselves, you know who you're thinking about, women, when you dress modestly? You're thinking of everybody else. When we have good behavior, you know what I'm convinced of? Just like the Good Samaritan, we're thinking of everybody else. Five things. If a man desires the office of a bishop, he must be blameless. The husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, and of good behavior. Let's pray.